All right, Andrew, we are back after we messed up our last episode completely.
Yeah, I had a meltdown, so we couldn't publish it. I had an emotional meltdown. I was like a pregnant woman or something, you know. Must be the time of year.
That happens to the best of us, I guess.
Yeah. So, OG Rose, I want to say two things. I want to say two words, or it's actually two syllables and a word. OG Rose, original gangster Rose. OG Rose is doing a course on November 4th, and it's going to be completely awesome. He's an awesome guy, him and his wife. So actually, OG is Daniel, Daniel and Michelle Gardner. They're the original gangsters of philosophy, basically. And we're going to be talking about planning and in uncertain times, it'll be, and really thinking about the works of Ivan Illich, who is my all-time favorite philosopher, human being, one of my all-time favorite philosophers, human beings. So we had a course with Bonita Roy, which was fantastic, and we're having a course with OG, which is going to be fantastic, and we're having more interviews with Bonita and Alexander and all kinds of things are happening here at Parallax. How is that for a plug?
Fantastic, Andrew.
Yeah.
Great.
You liked it? Really?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, okay, good. Oof.
No, I was like showing a friend of mine, you know, the trailer of the for the OG Rose course, and she just said, I'm not even lying. That's so charming. You know,
it was so beautiful and yeah, wonderful. Yeah, those tours.
I'm lying a lot, but in this case, I'm not lying. She actually said that. So check out the trailer for the OG Rose course.
Yeah, actually, the trailer, I played it for my son, who is 4 years old, and he said, play it again. And then he said,
really?
Play it again. And then he said, play it again. And 4 years old.
Mm.
Yeah, it really pulls at your heartstrings.
Hmm.
We should put the trailer in the link to in the description, yeah, so everybody can see it.
Yes. So, but today,
mm-hmm,
we have a topic.
Oh fuck! I hate this topic.
I love it. We're talking about the man, the first man in history,
mm-hmm,
that claims to have a final solution for an issue. Basically, you know, after 5,000 years of, you know, cultural evolution.
Let me guess, Adolf Hitler and Robert Sapolsky.
Exactly.
Same person.
Yes.
I'm not exaggerating.
I knew that I shouldn't have said final solution, but I don't know what the proper English expression for this is. So
now you're bullshitting.
So, yeah, but the first man, basically, in history of science and philosophy, who has the final answer to a human conundrum, and mm-hmm, and you know, all the discourse that happened in the last 2,000 years, philosophically speaking, came to a halt and come to an end with his exclamation that there is no free will, and the debate is just over now.
Yeah,
you know, you have to understand that for the next 20,000 years of human evolution, there will be nothing to add to this conversation anymore, because the thing is settled now.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Okay, that's a very good way to frame it. Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything against Robert Sapolsky or his science, because he's probably a good scientist. I just think that he's confusing categories, you know, of science and religion and philosophy, and he's putting into all one big category. And saying science proves that, you know, there's no free will. Science says there's no free will. It's the same thing as saying God says there's no free will. It's just the will of God, right? It's just Protestantism all over again. You know, you have no free will because God is everything and you're nothing. And so science is everything and you're nothing. And so, you know, free will is just this big illusion.
Right. I mean, there is a kind of consensus that, I don't know, 95% to 99% of our behavior is kind of conditioned and is kind of determined.
Absolutely. And,
but to say that we are 100% automatons, I think that's kind of absurd. And I think, you know, there are arguments to be made.
There's no way out of the matrix. It's just like, we're just in a matrix. Yeah. So we can forget about the red pill. Just take the blue pill.
Yeah, well, his argument would be that even taking the red pill would be determined by previous neurobiological, neurochemical kind of processes and experiences and whatnot.
I mean, there might be something true to that. On if you look at them, you see that it might be true that most of our choices, most of our choices are sort of determined. But there's still this window of free will, I think. That's how I see it.
Yeah, so he had like this talk with Jim Rutt, and they were using this metaphor as a crack, where free will, appears through all, that conditioned behavior. And if there's something that, if the causality and the determinism is 100%, or if there's some crack somewhere. And I mean, I don't think there's an end argument there. I think it's basically a very old discussion, that is there at the moment between determinism and non-determinism, or causality and acausality, or whatever. But what strikes me, from looking, looking at it from a kind of macro perspective, is that it's so weird, because the whole of our enlightenment, the enlightenment phase and secularization and whatnot, this is based on the idea that we have free will, and that we can decide, and that we are responsible for our actions, and that we are responsible for, not choosing a traditional religious mindset, let's say. And so this idea that everything is determined to 100% is kind of counter enlightenment.
It's going back to the belief in God, basically, because that is like a belief in a totality that controls everything, and that we're sort of not even part of that. We're kind of like, so it's yeah, there's a subtle dualism there, right?
Right.
I think that
it's a bit. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that, it's also like, it's a bit like, I can choose to raise my hand. I just did. I'm going to raise my hand, and then I raise my hand. What? Of course, I can. I mean, this is obvious to me. So, what is the argument? Like, what is the difference? Does he say we can make choices, or just no choices? We can't make choices. Because what's the difference between free will and choices? Isn't free will just a fancy way of saying I can make a choice?
No, in his mind, there's nothing that is not determined. And so there's no way that you could make a decision or a choice that is not determined by previous mechanisms and experiences and biochemical processes. So everything that you do is predetermined. And so in some sense, he says, you're not even responsible for your actions.
Yeah.
Because it's all so.
So it takes out of responsibility. Takes out responsibility from the. That's why it's kind of a dangerous philosophy. And then he says at one point, we can't live with that. Right. Or so he writes. I think the second part of his book is, how do we live with that? How do we live with that? And he says, no, we can't really live with it. It's very difficult to live with that. That's why we need this illusion of free will, etc., so that we can live, because it's very, very difficult to live with that. So it's sort of like almost like the idea that only the really brave people understand that we are determined, and that. Again, you see these days is sort of a form of Protestantism, I would say. Like, all these philosophical arguments, they're just more Protestantism.
Well, what I think, Andrew, is that that you can't answer this question on the level of the behavior itself. You know, because mm-hmm. You could always say, okay, lifting my arm or like grabbing the phone, that's 100% determined, you know, by previous action. And it's mostly probably is. But I think to answer this question, you have to look at the thing in itself, right? For example, mm-hmm. like this Nietzschean idea that you can't think in less than two. Right? For every yes, there's a no. For every black, there's a white. For every, you know, for every deterministic, you know, mind frame is a non-deterministic, because they're kind of enabling each other. You can't think yes without a no. You can't think, you know, death without life. You can't think determinism without non-determinism. It's just conceptually impossible. You can't mm-hmm. think causality without a causality. So that was what Nietzsche meant. You can't think in less than two, because these categories relate to each other. And sure, if you're within the mind frame or the frame of science, sure, but you have to, philosophy's way is to look at how do we come to some things like truth or concepts. And as long as you think in deterministic mindset, you have to contend with the fact that you're enabling non-determinism with that. And with that, conceptually speaking, you create free will, right?
That's interesting. So like his statement that there's only determinism, one could also make the statement that there is no determinism.
Determinism makes only sense in context of non-determinism. Mm-hmm. It's always the great other to each other.
Form is emptiness, emptiness is form.
Yeah, you can't think only form. You can't think only emptiness. It always is both. It's always a you know, and philosophy's job is, you know, to point out that, you know, okay, it might be hard to prove that what you're doing is actually a free will, but conceptually speaking, you know, it has to be there, you know, mm-hmm. and in fact, it is the life experience of most of us that we do that. And so to just have a deterministic, materialistic mindset to say, no, it is not there, which is kind of in opposition to the life experience to all of us, that's kind of, it's a kind of weird move on the chessboard.
But yeah, I mean, it's an absolutist view. It's a fanatical view in a way. All right. Like we have to acknowledge karma. Let's say determinism is karma, right? It's like actions that have, you know, there's a cause and effect, there's a causal. But actually, like if you get into the meaning of karma, karma means you do affect karma. You by doing things, right? By making choices, by free choices.
Yeah.
Right? You're not fully governed by this, you know, law of causation. You know, so the idea of karma frees you from karma. It's kind of like what you're saying, you know, the understanding of determinism on a certain level makes you understand there's also, yeah, I totally agree. There also is no complete determinism.
Even
I've heard somebody say that like everything is free will up until the point that you're enlightened and then there's no free will.
Well, okay. Yeah, that would be a completely different angle. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So.
But I mean, it's like even the idea of, I mean, I made some notes, so I was making sure that to, you know, have the right marching route here. But even the idea of emergence is the idea that something comes up that is not fully explainable by the elements that, you know, came before. That's the mm-hmm. whole idea. And you find mm-hmm. that in biology. That's the funny thing. That is originally like a biological concept, right? That you have, and you know, for example, the explosion of species in the Cambrian phase, where just from one moment to another, like a leap of new
complexity,
forms,
mm-hmm.
yeah, new complexity emerged, which were not fully, you know, explainable by what came before. That's the whole idea, right? And so I was, you know, equally saying, you know, I was talking about enlightenment. And so we have, at the moment, politically speaking, we have an attack on enlightenment, you know, through this Palestinian-Israeli crisis, because, you know, we, as the West, we have, I mean, if just think about it, how strange that is to have an enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had that. you know, and we kind of take it for granted. You know, all the Middle East, they never had that. And maybe you can't really explain how that emerged. But now we have to take a stand for it, I think, at least. You know, it's something that
I do too, actually.
That is precious.
Often I argue against this notion of enlightenment because I think it gives you the illusion that we're not religious creatures, that we're just, you know, that we can suddenly become autonomous, rational beings, and that there is something wrong about that as well. But on the other hand, it is a quantum leap from, let's say, a God-centered world to a human-centered world.
Right.
You know, and that's a quantum leap. So that is a quantum leap to a new humanism is a quantum leap for sure. Although it's not the final quantum leap. Like, I wouldn't say, like, I think people get stuck in humanism. Like, I think that, like, Jim Rutten, I all the best to Jim, and he's a wonderful fellow, but he's somewhat stuck in the Enlightenment. And the people are kind of stuck in the Enlightenment. So we need to defend the Enlightenment as being one stage and not skip that stage of humanism. But there's like the world where God is the center. That's the Middle Ages and the medieval world, and much of the Muslim world today. It's like the God is the center, and the human doesn't matter. And then you move into the Renaissance and humanism, and then you move from a God perspective. You know, Tractor McKibben explains to me, you moved from a God perspective to a human perspective, and suddenly humans are the center of the universe. Even in art, you see, like, suddenly we have realism in perspective, right? Where we're depicting the human being in its realism instead of as some symbolic portal to God or whatever. And then the next stage is the next stage is like, then abstract art comes in and deconstructs the human all over again. Because cubism and like Cézanne, who destroyed perspective altogether and created this whole new free expression where every point is, we're in the quantum universe or something like that. That's probably a vulgar analogy to people who do quantum physics, but we're in another kind of realm. So yes, we have to defend humanism against monotheistic, you know, fundamentalism. That I agree with. But then we also have to critique humanism at the same time, on some level, I feel.
Sure. You know that I, you know, all the integral model, you know, or spiral dynamics, these things that put all these kind of stages in a kind of form of spiral or ladder or whatever. But, you know, in terms of recent events, I was really thinking about, okay, so what if enlightenment was a freak accident, like a freak emergence that is not explainable by what came before, just some precious little thing, you fall in love, you know, that you have something like an emergence, something new. Yeah. You know, and I don't know if there's a ladder. I don't know if postmodernity is just an extension of humanism and modernity. You know, it is just, you know, linguistically. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you know, we have to cherish this. And, you know, it's so unlikely that happened. The whole world was God-centric. And then suddenly something happened. And you have now this attack. Politically speaking, you know, you have all these activists, which is crazy to me, you know, that, you know, the queer activists that kind of are basically the result of modernistic and humanistic thinking, mm-hmm. kind of cheer for, you know, something that completely undermines the whole way of living.
Well, it makes sense in a way.
And then just last point, and then you have scientists like Sapolsky that can only be scientists because of humanism and science and modernism, but then completely undermine the project. And that's weird to me, that, you know, that we're like in this phase of attack of that beautiful thing that we have.
Well, maybe analytically speaking, you know, we have to look at it that way. It's like, when you destroy God, you don't have a daddy anymore. So there's a nostalgia for daddy, like there's a nostalgia for this top down, you know, fundamentalist. So in the LGBT community or whatever, whereas anything goes, where it's very supposedly free and it's free sexuality and free expression and everything free. There's too much freedom, so there's this perverse desire for this, you know, top down monotheistic, medieval worldview where everything had an order to it and everything was in its place and and everybody knew who they were and it's the shadow effect. It's basically the shadow, So fundamentalism is the shadow of extreme relativism or extreme, yeah. Extreme madness of categories of self-invented categories, where every single person becomes a category, of their own, and so that leads to mass homogenization again. I would say it's like.
That's funny that you say that, because it's like, we are so embedded within religion, and if you look at Sapolsky, he looks like straight out of the, the Old Testament. He looks like the guy who gets an instruction from God to kill his son. And then he leads his son to the mountain. Then God yes. says, oh, no, what the fuck are you doing? But you told me to. I'm completely, I'm doing everything. I'm completely deterministic. I have new free will. If you tell me to kill my son, I certainly will do it. That's how he looks like, and it's like we are so embedded within religion and all these old concepts,
Well, religion, there's an extreme religiosity among the so-called hyper-rational enlightenment types, right?
Yeah.
They're the most religious because they have no religion. It's a dialectic. We're going back to Hegel, Yeah, I think it's just kind of like, well, I was thinking about this, where I was thinking about trust. I was, Benita Roy had this thing in a course about different styles of trust. And I think that the people who I distrust are the ones who that are the fundamentalist rationalists. They're a person I profoundly distrust. Rationalists,
right?
Like full on rationalists who are fundamentalists about rationalism.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm agreeing that enlightenment rationality is a wonderful, thing to inspire towards. But in the same way I might distrust an actual fundamental, like a religious fundamentalist, I would distrust somebody who has a totalizing view of science or anything, actually,
Exactly. I mean, that's the weird thing, that somebody like Sapolsky, who should know about Popper, who should know about Kuhn and all these people, that he still has the balls to proclaim a final statement on an issue. Mm-hmm. It's like that's fundamentalist thinking. Science is developing. I get that you have a partial view on things.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't Nietzsche do away with absolutism?
Yeah, but why do you mm-hmm. even strive for an absolute absolute statement? That doesn't make any sense to me. You should know, especially as a humanistic scientist, that things are way more fluid than it appears to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's the answer. It's like a fear of fluidity. It's like the hyper-rational intellectual wants to pin everything down to some great theory of everything, which is extremely. The theory of everything is a big seduction, because it's like. It's like, okay, now I can understand everything, and therefore I'm secure, or I understand that everything is determined, so I don't have to look at my own sins or my own. I don't have to look at the world in an ethical way at all, in a sense. It's kind of a, that's why I guess you started this off with Nazism, but it's a purely anti-ethical perspective, it would seem to me, to say everything is determined.
I don't know what happens with people, you know, when they're like so embedded and so revered in a certain mm-hmm. field, and then you start out and then you're a professor, you're a tenured professor, you know, 30 years at a university, and you know, and then something happens to you that you become an absolutist, and for me it's just an indication that some people have to go. It's like, okay, your time has passed, you know, you became an absolutist, now please go. It's like there's nothing left after that, you know. There's
so it's
nothing.
Like a reification of
I love his, you know, lectures, they're great, but you know, the moment when somebody strives for something absolute, it's, you know, you're done basically.
Mm-hmm.
You belong
mm-hmm.
to the old generation that needs to go, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's
because you can't remain on the liminal edge of things where things are actually really happening, you know, on the liminal edge of things. That's where stuff's going on. That's what's really going on.
And I think the argument is not that really difficult to make, like for free will. So if you have, for example, you imagine you have a deterministic worldview and you put everything in, mm-hmm. everything that you have. You know, biases, causality, perspectives, you know, and then you do the same thing for, you know, non-determinism. And then you have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which mm-hmm. road do you want to go? And I think mm-hmm. if you're prudent and put all of the things in these two categories, you know, then you can freely decide which world frame you wanna choose.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is true, though. You know, I notice that people are much more determined than they think they are. But isn't that the whole point of our existence, is to break free of that sort of determinism? Like, in a sense, isn't that what the spiritual path is about? What, you know, science is about, what is to break free from, let's say, deterministic worldview. Like, it's just, isn't that what being human is? Like,
I completely agree. You have to contend with the fact that most behaviors are deterministic, but also you have to find your personal way of, you know, shining light through the cracks.
That's what creativity is.
That's what Andrew means, that's what Tom means, that what existence means, you know, to find our way where we're just not only automatons.
Yeah, we have this Gorgon knot, or we have to break, or, you know, we have to struggle with existence so that we don't become what Gurdjieff called machine man. So it's like as if he's saying everything is machine, right? And, you know, that's all we are, as machines. We're just machines. We're just atoms, you know, that are in a certain kind of arrangement, and they kind of bounce off other atoms. And I've heard Sam Harris say the same thing. It's like this is how he defines life. Life is just a bunch of atoms. You know, that's what it is. Whereas that is not our ontological experience. You know, that is not our experience. Our experience of life is we're writing, we're creating it as we go along. It's more like I have more sympathy for the idea that it's a story than it's a bunch of atoms. Like it's a narrative that we're constructing. It's kind of a dynamic narrative that's always being constructed.
I mean, you don't even have to be like a materialist. Even if you go into psychology, most psychologists will tell you that, again, 99.9, even Sloterdijk said that 99.9% of behaviors is determined by previous cognitive experiences and traumas and, you know, imprints and whatnot. But again, it doesn't add up to 100, and that's the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, I think as long as you can think of the option of emergence and let's call it freedom or free will, then it is there. That's one of the magic secrets of the of our existence. As long as you have the category, mm-hmm. as long as you can think that, you know,
And that's kind of his argument, that there is no magic, right? That is his argument. There's no such thing as magic. It's an anti-magic argument. It's like it's an anti. There is no magic. It's just all mechanical.
Or in psychoanalytical words, it's a death drive. You know, it's the drive towards repetition, and death, and that's it. There's no way of, you know, what Alexander Bard calls the exodus into something new, into a new paradigm, into, you know, the libidinal force that, you know, disrupts that what is, basically.
Yeah. I totally agree. He's trying to create another Platonic structure that's fully, you know, it's just wheels and wheels within wheels within wheels. And it's perfectly, we're not involved in it at all, right? If there's no free will, we'd have no involvement in our lives. We have no choice. Like we're not dancers, and you know, we're just puppets. And that is a dark view. I mean, like, that is the way a lot of people behave, just like puppets. So again, there's a critique. There's something true about the determinism, but yeah, why make it 100%? And the 1% is more valuable than the 99%, obviously, or even the 0.0001% of non-determinism means more than the rest of determinism. What does Leonard Cohen say? You know, the crack.
I mean, you're mentioning something very interesting. I didn't thought of that before. I mean, what if for the majority of the masses, an expression like there is no free will is actually true? But if the thing is a pyramid, you know, so if no. if it's the question is if it's true for all people, or if there's a subset of people who can experience free will, and I don't know who that would be, you know, yeah. But just, I mean, like...
Something bothers me about that, though, because it's kind of elitist. It's like,
oh, well,
why can't a plumber experience free will as much as a physicist or a yogi, or, you know, why can't a...
No, I'm not making a value judgment about jobs. I'm just... trying to phrase it in a way that, okay, so maybe for a lot of people there is actually no free will if you look at how embedded in their social life they are, and how unconscious they are, or like how embedded they are in beliefs in God and paradise, and we just see that how automatic the response is. And you know, let's look at Israel and Palestine, how automated the responses are actually, and how predictable, you know, and if people even aren't able to, you know, look at it, you know, in a way that includes, you know, that is aware of their own biases. So that's like an automatic behavior. But
Gurdjieff would say that people are asleep, right, you know?
Right, yeah. But yeah. does that mean that all people at all time are asleep? Or if there's a subset that might become awake or express free will. And you know, it's like to pass on that value judgment onto men, that every man since the dawn of time and for all eternity, all the people
are asleep.
That's a value judgment that I wouldn't do.
No, but I also think there's levels of awakeness, of course, but there's, you know, when all people, right? Everybody has a quality of awakeness somewhere in them. Even the most, you know, the dumbest, most asleep person, they still have a unique quality to them, right? They still have something. Like even the worst person, they still have some awake quality. They still have some sort of free will. Like people in concentration camps have some sort, like as Viktor Frankl would say, they still can make some choice. Like he's saying the opposite of Viktor Frankl, right? Viktor Frankl says the only thing you have is free will, right? That's all you have. Anything can be taken away from you. Your whole life can be taken away from you by bullies and tyrants, and you could end up in Auschwitz, but you still have while you're there, you still have a choice to act in a certain way or not.
I'm going on a limb here, but what you are saying and what he is basically saying is that there is no a difference in responsibility between the inmates and the guards of Auschwitz, because both are equally not free. And that's the argument that Sapolsky is making. And that's insane. That's insane.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's the opposite of Viktor Frankl's statement saying, this is all you have is your free will, right? That's all you really have. Right. When it comes down to it, when it comes down to the most, you know, if you're in Gaza or something and, you know, whatever, if you're in the extreme,
you can transcend pain. Yes.
If you're in the extreme hell, you have a choice. Okay. Are you going to, you know, just go with the monstrous and just, you know, are you going to do something a little bit different, you know, or, you know, are you going to act in some manner of kindness, or are you just gonna go into evil, right? So I mean, it's like these people who say there's no such thing as evil, or, you know, it's like, give me a break. I mean, maybe on some ultimate level, yes, it's just ignorance, but just look around you, right? You know,
I mean, the issue is that, you know, that it is in the last instance, it's a philosophy of a man who has no libido anymore. That's what it is.
Yeah, right. So, yeah,
it's an
as
old
Nietzsche
man
says, everybody's philosophy is really a biography, you know. So it's a last man philosophy. There's no free will. That's very good. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page here.
Yeah. Good that we settled that. We just rescued mankind from the grips of Sapolsky's death
deterministic
drive.
deterministic death drive philosophies. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I just, again, I think, you know, I believe there's, you know, I experienced emergence. I know that is a valid scientific concept, and, you know,
or novelty, or
when novelty happens, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And again, but I still don't understand. Like, does he say we can't make a choice ever? Is that what he's saying? It's like, doesn't make any reasonable sense. There's no sense to that. There's no common sense whatsoever to that. You can argue yourself out of all common sense. You could build this completely absurd philosophy, like just absurd. It's just like, it's out of, and you can make it sound coherent and gather all these followers who parrot what you think. And, you know, there's no free choices, no free will. And they'll just parrot that. And they'll feel like they're very enlightened. They'll make the free choice to adopt this silly, absurdist philosophy. And they'll, you know, trumpet it around.
No, I mean, like from a medical and from a biological viewpoint, I mean, it makes sense what he says. There are these famous experiments that, you know, where you measure brain activity and then, you know, that show that the decision that the brain makes is like 5 or 10 seconds before it comes into your consciousness where you do the choice. But the actual choice was made by the brain like 5 to 10 seconds before. So you can show that, you know, your conscious choice is, in a kind of sense, an illusion. And within that frame, without that biological frame, it makes sense. But it is still only a frame. And that's what he kind of forget, that there are different frames and understandings of, you know, of engaging with life and experience.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, yes, but it's not just that. It's just and something else. You know, can't just throw philosophy and let's say spirituality or complexity theory. You can't just throw it out, you know, and just zone in into like a kind of biologistic kind of worldview that, you know, that it makes life poor if you do that. You need additional perspectives to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that it's not, that the biological viewpoint is not valid. I get that. You know, it is science. It is, you know, but it is not everything. And that's and that's why we have philosophy to analyze these different frames of, you know, understanding and experience.
And when you make it everything, your science, your religion dressed up as science, you're just doing scientism, or
exactly.
You're absolutizing your science. And again, it's this tendency to absolutize things that really gets people in trouble, you know.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's like, imagine you copulate with your partner, like on the straight biological level. What happens is some friction and some firing of some neurons, you know.
but it doesn't
add
have
up
to bring to, the sex in now, huh?
Yeah, but it doesn't add up to the transcendence that you can actually experience. And I don't even talking about, you know, the fluffy feelings or the joy or the love or the ecstasy. No, I mean, I'm talking about actual tantric transcendence that can happen out of nowhere, you know, where it's just like, oh shit, I'm completely, I was taken away by something that I didn't expect and that I didn't even like have conceptions of that could even happen. You know, that just, you know, when something happened that is not explainable by, you know, shitty sex before, you know,
when you meet God while you're having shitty sex.
Yeah, that happens. Yeah. That can happen. That, and it's called, you know, Aurobindo talks about this, you know, this grace when I don't know what God is, but if that other kind of decides to have, you know, empathy with you and lifts you up and takes you out of the shell of determinism and biology and just makes something, you know, and puts you into that transcendent peak state, whatever that is.
So I wonder what would happen if Mr. Sobolsky actually had that experience. Would he just interpret it as being some sort of like Freud interpreted sort of like this mother experience back to the womb, or is that how he would he interpret it, or would it, if he really had that experience, would it be just undeniable to him that his entire construct is wrong?
Well, I think neither Sapolsky nor Freud really had ever a real transcendental tantric experience.
That's what I suspect as well. Actually, there was a guy. Yeah, I mean, there was an interesting thing I was reading. Freud was had this mystic friend, and the mystic friend was trying to convince him about these things, like what you're talking about. And Freud was just saying, well, you know, I'm a scientist, and, you know, so I don't go there. But as far as I can see, it's just, you know, the infantile oceanic, you know, the sense of the oceanic infantile. And so, I guess Freud didn't. First of all, he didn't have that experience. Second of all, he didn't have any curiosity about what these people who have those kind of experiences actually experience.
Yeah.
Because it's not this, you know, sucking on a tit thing. It's something else, right? It's like, it's something quite different. You know, this supernal, you know, when you meet the supernal crown of Keter and
it's like what Wilbur so beautifully, you know, distinguished, you know, between the pre-rational states of, you know, being engulfed in the motherly womb and these feelings, and then the transcendental higher forms, the post egoic and post-rational kind of transcendental states that are nothing like the pre-egoic ones. And
where they have a kind of intelligence to them, like there's a sense of there's a higher intelligence at work, or
and they defy rational description. That's why they're transrational, because you know, it's like you can't just put a motherly womb label on it, because that's not what it is. There's way more, and it's beyond rational description. That's why it's transrational, you know. It's there's something else going on that we try to wrestle with in that moment. It's not just, you know, oceanic embeddedment,
Let's say. I know. I always make that argument too, but then people are really. People have, you know, they found their hill to die on, so to speak, and they're, this is what I believe, and so I'm not going to have that experience, and they sort of boundary themselves away from having those more, let's say, transcendental experiences, which are, you know, maybe not even that much, those experiences are not that big in themselves, they're just sort of portals to possibility, or what you call emergence, or possibility of the insane possibilities, right, that are there. It's like the insane potentials. Just absolutely insane what the potentials are. And then how we...
Yeah, especially the potentials that you don't even know of. Then it gets interesting, because you could always make the case that the potentials that you know of are, you know, determined by your previous thinking. But there is this category of the potentials that you don't know of, and we're talking about those. And as long as we can talk about those, we can open up a space to let those things happen and occur. And that's all that I'm saying. As long as you have the linguistic categories for it. You know, because we are linguistic structures, our whole experience is, you know, what, you know, Lynch says, our life is, you know, governed by dreams, you know, and because we're like in this symbolic and imaginary kind of world. And as long as we do have the categories, we make room for these experiences. That's all that Worf, you know, not the Star Trek guy, but the linguist, basically.
Like fingers pointing to the moon, so to speak, or I think we're on the same page. Why were we arguing last time? Last time we were arguing and yet we agree. What were we arguing about?
No, last time at the shitty podcast when we decided to not publish it or what?
Yeah.
No, I think we made the mistake, like stupid beginners after 110 episodes, not to have at least a minimal consensus about the topic we want to talk about. So we're just starting winging it, and so it's like there was no red thread through all of this, and so we just got bogged down, you know, in okay, so what are we actually talking about? That was the reason why we didn't publish anything last week, but now I think we made a beautiful episode.
Yes, I think last week I was defending fundamentalism and this week I'm criticizing it. Like, I don't like rational people, okay? I'm an irrational being. I contradict myself all the time. I say something and then I believe something differently next week. You know, I'm not consistent. I'm not coherent. And I don't want to be.
Yeah.
I don't want to be coherent. You know, like, you know, Stop Making Sense, that beautiful film by David Byrne. Stop Making Sense. It's like it's like, throw away your certainties and your formulas and your, you know, stop making sense. Then you'll start to make art, you know, then you'll start to have choices and, you know, like things will appear that are interesting.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Namaste, everybody.
Namaste, everybody.